Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric David. And continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. It's a great thing when one of your childhood heroes only grows in stature as you grow, because it's almost like you can root for a winner. And one of those winners I got to root for, or I've been able to root for, is H.P. Lovecraft. Like a lot of weird 13-year-old boys, I was obsessed with Lovecraft's writings. And when I grew up, which was in the 70s, in the early 80s, it was really easy to find his work, because there were all these used paperbacks from the great wave of occult and fantasy literature that came into print in the 1960s for the slightly older weirdos. And so I consumed, you know, Lovecraft in a way that wasn't just exactly fictional. I also got my hands on the one of the many versions of the Necronomicon, a grimoire that appears in Lovecraft's fiction and that has achieved a variety of expressions in published form in a variety of different editions. A very interesting example of a mythical book becoming real in a number of ways, and its mixture of Sumerian magic and medieval lore and ritual was most intriguing and helped set me on my path towards my own interest in magic and the history of the occult, which has played a very interesting role in H.P. Lovecraft's continuing popularity, because even as he has grown in literary stature, such that now he's sort of recognized as one of the most important and significant horror writers and pulp writers of the 20th century in America, and you know, there's an enormous critical literature on him, and a volume of his stories coming out from the Library of America, which is kind of the great canon-making part of American letters. But in addition to that, there's been this incredibly rich interaction between Lovecraft's fiction, let's say, and the magical underground, the people interested in ceremonial magic and the left-hand path, and a variety of novel and ancient approaches to ceremonial ritual and invocation. A very interesting, very rich world that was already, you know, well on its way decades ago and has only gotten more interesting. And, you know, into that gap came our guest for today. Donald Tyson has been writing a thick stream of texts on ritual magic and other topics, as well as some fiction, since the late 1980s. And over the last chunk of time, over this last decade, he's written a number of books exploring H.P. Lovecraft and the relationship with the mass stream of magical experience and lore in a variety of guises, mostly for Llewellyn books. The book that turned me on to his Lovecraftian writings was, I think, one of the more recent, The Dream World of H.P. Lovecraft, which is a really nice mixture of biography, critical reflection on Lovecraft's fiction and what makes it interesting and what's unique about it, but also a way of engaging its deeper content, and especially with the sort of great conundrum that lingers over any occult engagement with Lovecraft, which is the peculiar fact that, at least if we're to take him at his word, he was a hardened rationalist, far more materialistic, skeptical, and reductive than even your average scientist today. So it's a very interesting thing to think about where the deeper magic lies in these fictions by a hard-headed materialist. So with no further ado, I'll welcome Donald Tyson onto the show. Donald, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Great, great. And you're Canadian. You live in Nova Scotia.
That's correct.
You know, I've always imagined Nova Scotia as a very beautiful place. Do you have like a beautiful view out your windows?
It's pretty good. It's I live in a farming area now in on the island of Cape Breton, which is in northern Nova Scotia. If you've been to New England and Maine, you get a pretty good idea of what Nova Scotia looks like.
Right.
A lot of forests, a lot of lakes.
Well, since we're talking about New England, and of course that's where Lovecraft's from, I had looked a little bit trying to find some biographical information about you, and I noticed another kind of Lovecraft connection that you were really into astronomy when you were a lad, and you know built a telescope, and that kind of reminded me. I said, oh yeah, you know Lovecraft is something similar, and I'm kind of curious about. You know, a little bit about your background in terms of when in your evolution of your interest in science and then your interest in ritual magic, when did you encounter Lovecraft's fiction?
Well, I started reading stories that were occult and horror stories and also science fiction when I was 9 years old. I started reading Heinlein and Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke. And I also got into the horror fiction of H.P. Lovecraft around that age. So in my early teens, I was reading Lovecraft, and even before that, that was my introduction to him.
Was that partly linked to your interest in astronomy? So you got into science fiction and the kind of cosmic themes?
Well, my life parallels Lovecraft's in a surprising number of ways, and one of those ways is that when I was young, I was fascinated by astronomy, and I wanted to be a professional astronomer. Now, Lovecraft also wanted to be a professional astronomer, and Lovecraft finally had to give up his dream of being an astronomer when he found that he couldn't do the mathematics. He just didn't have the mind for the mathematics that was required for professional astronomy. And he dropped out of high school in his final year. He didn't quite finish high school. And he just kind of went into an intense depression. Now, I didn't quite have the same experience, but when I was younger, I wanted to be a professional astronomer, and I tried to get into engineering in university, and my grades just weren't there for engineering, so I ended up finally taking an arts degree. So I was disappointed in my ambitions just as Lovecraft was, and in the same field. Now, Lovecraft went into literature kind of as a default. You know, he enjoyed reading stories about the weird and the fantastic because they were similar to the dreams that he had. He had dreams of the strange and fantastic landscapes and mysterious cities that no one had ever seen, mysterious beings, horrible nightmares he had. And he, for some reason, he found a kind of release from his fear of these dreams in fantastic literature. And he eventually began to write stories that were based on his dreams. So he went from being an astronomer, an amateur astronomer, to being a writer of weird fiction. And I've done pretty much the same thing. I mean, I went from being a hard-headed materialist and an atheist and someone who wanted to take up astronomy as a profession, and I've become much more spiritual. And I'm also writing very similar things to what Lovecraft wrote.
Yeah, well, let's stay with that scientific background is really interesting. Not only does it explain part of your connection with Lovecraft, who combined these modes in his own very interesting, unique way, but it also kind of, you know, actually leads into some of what's appealing about ceremonial magic and the history of the occult, because when we, you know, in modern times, when you say the word occult or you talk about magic, you know, we have a tendency to put it far away from anything that has to do with science. In fact, they're almost like these great enemies. But of course, as you know, since you've done work on the history of the occult and magic as well, you know, not only in its modern expression, that of course these worlds are very deeply woven together. And so I'm kind of curious for you, since you were a materialist and had those kind of convictions, and you're working with science and appreciating the scientific worldview, what happened to you that sort of opened up the need for a spiritual quest or for a fascination with more, recondite matters?
Well, around the time I was attending university, I had a kind of a revelation or epiphany. I suddenly realized that atheism and materialism was a dead end intellectually. I mean, it didn't have any meaning. You couldn't go anywhere with it. It was arid. It was just a wasteland, and if you stuck with it, you know, your mind was always going to be very limited. I just came to a realization that the world is it's not a dead material place. It's a spiritual place, and it's a living place. And Lovecraft never consciously reached that realization. You know, all his life he was a declared atheist and materialist. And when anyone would say, "Do you believe in the stories, the things you write in your stories?" he'd laugh at them and say, "No, of course I don't. They're all nonsense. You know, I write fantasy stories." So, but I, on the other hand, I came to a realization that materialism just didn't cut it. It's just not enough to explain the world we live in. The world is much bigger and much more complex and much more interesting than any materialistic philosophy could possibly describe. And the gateway for me was the tarot. I've said this before to various interviews. My brother had a set of tarot cards, and I wasn't really interested in the tarot. I used to make fun of him for paying attention to the tarot because I thought it was silly, you know. But then one afternoon, I was alone in the house, and I had a few hours with nothing to do, and I saw the tarot deck, and I just picked it up and started laying the cards out in different patterns and looking at the symbolism on the cards. And that opened my mind. I saw that the cards had meanings that lay below the level of language. That is to say, the meanings that were being revealed to me by the different patterns of tarot cards couldn't be described. There were no words to describe the symbolic relationships. But at the same time, I realized that those symbolic relationships had meaning. And that was the doorway for me into a study of esoteric philosophy. And Lovecraft never made that transition. I mean, he was mystical by nature, but he always denied his mystical side. He always clung to his materialism. And my theory is the reason he clung to his materialism is because he was terrified that the mystical side of his nature would overwhelm his mind and drive him into insanity.
Yeah, I found your reading quite appealing. You know, there's, because other, you know, there have been, you know, magicians who have been working in the Lovecraftian lore for quite a long time, and so they're, in a way, they almost kind of have to answer this question: well, how could it be the case that there's some kind of magical efficacy in these fictions written by somebody who didn't think they were worth anything other than fantasy and distraction? And so people have come up with different ways of trying to describe it, and I thought you did a very nuanced job of explaining psychologically why, because these extraordinary dreams. I mean, he just had an extraordinary dream life, incredibly detailed, long, rich with information, continuous, you know, sometimes whole narratives that would work as stories. You know, most of our dream lives aren't so rich, and there are definitely dreaming savants out there. I mean, there are people who just have very different kinds of dream lives that are extraordinary, but his were so dark that you could totally see somebody going like, wow, I'm like, he's like unusually in touch with the mystical or the depth or whatever, however you want to characterize that other realm. But at the same time, frightened about letting any of that come in, and also living at a time when a certain kind of materialism and a certain kind of scoffing and a certain kind of grip onto science was very popular and very, very understandable. So, I mean, so how do you see someone like that? Do you think he was just like a dreaming savant, that he was actually kind of like a shamanic personality, or how do you characterize what he was sort of like behind his materialism?
Well, I called him a sleeping philosopher, a sleeping prophet. I mean, the title is usually given to Edgar Cayce, but I think Lovecraft qualifies. I think he went on astral journeys in his sleep. You know, you've heard of astral projection, and usually people are considered to be awake when they do it, but astral projection is really not that much different from dreaming. It's really a kind of lucid dreaming. And the dream world is really the astral world. I think a lot of people don't quite realize that. When you dream, you're actually astrally traveling. Now, Lovecraft, he was able to remember his dreams very vividly, and he was aware in the dreams as a kind of a roving point of view. He could kind of fly over the cities in his dreams, and he could look down upon them and see the details there. And sometimes he was present in the characters in his dreams. He would realize that he was one of the people who was inhabiting these strange cities that he'd see. Now, he always scoffed at that. He always denied that that had any significance or relevance. But at the same time, he was obsessed with it. He wrote these stories about his dreams in order to control them. I mean, he was terrified of his dreams, and by writing them down and making stories out of them, he was able to give them the endings that he wanted to give them, and he was able to master his dreams in that way. But I think he was projecting astrally at an unconscious level. He didn't realize he was engaged in astral projection, and it wasn't particularly voluntary. Although I think maybe later in life, you know, he deliberately set himself to dream strange dreams so that he could get material for his stories.
Oh, I didn't know that. So what did he do to encourage the strange dreams?
Well, we don't know. I mean, there's no record of that. But at the same time, you know, he writes about how he enjoyed his dreams immensely. And many of his early stories are just... They're nothing more than a kind of a verbatim transcript of his dreams. And they work quite well on that level. You know, later he would use dream fragments and scenes, and he would incorporate them together with different characters and build his stories. But the earlier stories, some of them are just the dreams and nothing else. He wrote down the dreams, changed a few names, and that was it.
Yeah, and then on another level, of course, some of his later stories, they use the idea of the dream. Like, the dream becomes sort of a narrative place for characters who are otherwise like him, you know, in a very materialistic, realistic frame of mind. And then we as the readers start hearing about their dream life, and we start putting the pieces together before they start putting the pieces together. So that there's a reflection on dreaming on a lot of levels in his work.
Yeah, a very important aspect of Lovecraft's fiction is his dream traveler, Randolph Carter. And Carter is a... Carter of him. Yeah. He's Lovecraft's alter ego. And he travels through dreams. He's a master dreamer. He travels through dreams and he explores them, and he understands that he is dreaming, and he's able to interact with the characters of the dream world. Lovecraft wrote an entire novel, one of the few novels that he wrote, devoted to the dream world. And this character that he created was really an expression of himself deliberately entering into dreams and exploring dreams. Essentially, this character did what Lovecraft himself did.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you think that these... one of the questions about his work is that if you read the stories, you'll see there's similar entities are mentioned, different worlds, different characters, books, and there's a lot of similarities, a lot of things that tie things together, like the Necronomicon appears many times in Yarlothep and all these different beings. But they're also often slightly different context. Like, the dream stories have a kind of different feel than some of the later so-called Cthulhu-oriented texts. So it's like there's a shared universe, but the universe has a different, it manifests itself in different kinds of ways. And I'm curious, when you approach that as a kind of magical reality, as a sort of mythos in a deep sense, how do you deal with those differences? Like, how does it all fit together in your as you see it?
Well, I see Lovecraft's work as a coherence. He did write his dream stories are somewhat different in their feel from his what are called his mythos stories. But they are connected by, as you say, the use of the Necronomicon appears and various of great powerful beings, which Lovecraft generally referred to as the great old ones. And these beings are alien creatures, not only alien in space, but alien in dimensions, who are so powerful and ancient that they're on the level of gods for human beings. And part of Lovecraft's philosophy was that these creatures really didn't care what happened to humanity. They were present on the Earth before humans evolved, and they're still present here in various hidden places and in between the stars, as Lovecraft described it. But they don't care about humanity. Humanity to them is just a nuisance, something to be perhaps exterminated or used in minor ways. And that's what separates Lovecraft from other writers of the occult. His demonic beings, if you will, are not fighting the great fight between good and evil. They're just living their own purposes, and human values of good and evil mean nothing to them.
Well, what do you think accounts for that? I mean, it is such an extraordinarily fresh perspective. If you think about the history of, if you mythology and occult literature and demonology, there's something very unusual about it. I think it's related to his materialism in some sense, because in some ways it's sort of like an impersonal cosmic force rather than a moral, these guys are moral agents who are on the dark side. It's more like they're just sort of forces of the cosmos, but it seems deeper than that. What do you think accounts for the uniqueness of his...
It is unique, and I think it grew out of Lovecraft's, a combination of Lovecraft's interest in astronomy coupled with his strange and terrifying dreams. One thing astronomy gives you is a sense of just how big and how ancient the universe is. I don't think that anyone really appreciates how large the universe is if they haven't studied astrology. But Lovecraft studied it intensely, and he had a very good sense of just how big and how ancient the universe was. And by contrast, how brief and insignificant the human species was. Now, most writers, they write from the perspective of the human being, looking out upon the universe, and everything is related to humanity. Everything interacts with humanity as seen from a human point of view. Lovecraft, the unique thing about Lovecraft is he was able to step outside that and look at humanity from the outside. He was able to see humanity as a tiny, insignificant species that arose fairly late on in the evolution of the planet Earth, and which is going to probably cease to exist long before life ceases on the Earth. We're here for, we've been here for perhaps, in our present form, anywhere from a million years to some say as recently as 50,000 years. And a million years from now, we're probably going to be gone. We probably, if we exist at all, we'll be unrecognizable. And yet the Earth is billions of years old, so Lovecraft understood that, and he postulated that the Earth had been visited by, probably been visited by many intelligent species in the past, and would be visited by more intelligent species in the future. And these species wouldn't be in the least concerned with human beings, and they wouldn't be concerned with human interests. The things that make us human, Lovecraft understood that another species would probably not care about them. We care about them because they are part of our nature as a species, but a different species, a completely alien species. And Lovecraft's species, his aliens, are really completely alien. They're so alien that when they're killed, they dissolve into smoke. You know, some of them can't even be seen with the eyes because the material that composes them is so completely alien. We can't even see it. So Lovecraft's aliens just don't care about the things that human beings care about. And they don't care about human beings. So when they interact with human beings, their sheer indifference to the fate of humanity is terrifying. It's one of the things that elevates Lovecraft's stories to a higher level, in my opinion.
That was all really, really wonderful said, and I have a bunch of questions for you there, but we got to take a break here, and then we'll be right back. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. Masha's off today, and we're talking with Donald Tyson about Lovecraft and the occult, and we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis. We're talking with Donald Tyson today about H.P. Lovecraft and the occult. And we were just been talking about the terrifyingly alien character of Lovecraft's famous entities that have achieved such an interesting kind of viral power. You know, if you just look at the internet and the sorts of ideas and memes, as they say, that bounce around and kind of grab a hold and that people like to play with in sort of geek culture, that the Lovecraft lore and, of course, Cthulhu, not necessarily the greatest or grandest of his deities in many ways, but certainly a very memorable character, has a sort of life of his own, as do many, many, many of Lovecraft's aspects of his work, and the kind of question I have for you. Well, there's a couple of things that pop in my mind. One of them is that since a lot of the work that you've been doing in your Lovecraft series is to show how Lovecraft's world can be used as a workable system of ritual magic and how it connects to other themes in ritual magic, is a real basic question that someone would say, okay, I understand that some people might be interested in ritual magic and they might, want to explore other dimensions or other sides of consciousness through ritual means, invoking gods, whatever. They I get that. What I don't understand is why would anybody want to traffic with these terrifying creatures? And in a way, it's a kind of naive question. In a way, it's like the most important question. I'm really curious whether you talk about it in terms of the people who enjoy your books or your own interests or what that sort of, what the attraction and value of that kind of left-hand sort of approach to ritual experience is about.
Well, Lovecraft's great old ones certainly are dangerous and frightening and intimidating. There's no question about that. I think the attraction of them is potential for occult power, which they promise. You know, I think this can only be intuitive. People just have the sense that the Necronomicon as a mythical text is more potent than other mythical texts, and they have a sense that Lovecraft's great old ones have some basic, essential, hidden potency. And as to whether they're worth devoting time to or trying to interact with communicate with. You might ask the same thing about any of the gods of the past, the Greek gods or the Norse gods, or the angels of Judeo-Christianity, the angels whose names are written in the Old Testament. And all of those beings are interacted with in magic throughout the Western tradition, not only in the past up to the Renaissance, but even in modern times. People summon and communicate with the Archangel Michael, for example. And really, what interest has Michael, the Archangel, in the daily affairs of the average human being? Not a great deal, one would say. Or the god Thor, for example, is called upon for protection. Well, really, what interest does a god of elemental thunder and lightning have in protecting an individual human being in our modern times? So Lovecraft's gods, they are a bit more remote from humanity, but it's only a matter of degree. It's not an absolute division. And in fact, in Lovecraft's stories, his gods do interact with human beings. Yog-Sothoth, who is the great old one who controls all of the gateways between dimensions and from one world to another world, he can be summoned ritually. And Lovecraft describes the ritual summoning of him to open gateways. And he can also be summoned to raise the dead. In one of Lovecraft's novels, The case of Charles Dexter Ward, a ritual incantation to Yog-Sothoth is used to raise the dead from their essential salts. So, and Narlathotep, who is usually described as an ancient Egyptian figure, although he has many avatars. He's a kind of a trickster. He's kind of similar to Loki in Norse mythology, and he enjoys interacting with humanity. Of all Lovecraft's great old ones, he's the most apt to interact with humanity, but he's also the most dangerous because he enjoys toying with humanity and tempting human beings, and he enjoys watching them suffer to some extent. So he's a rather dangerous character to invoke, although there's a good deal of power potentially to be gained by invoking him.
Now, a question I want to ask you now is that whatever Lovecraftian magic is, i.e., whatever the nature of these gods are, they're partly figments of his dreaming, there are partly literary creations that he did as a fantasy writer. They partly, you know, tap into maybe archetypal energies or cosmic forces, if you want to take that whole perspective. But regardless of all that, it's clear that part of the power of his lore is the way that it blends and blurs fact and fiction, and that, you know, Necronomicon is introduced as a fictional text inside of a fiction, a mythical book, and yet even Lovecraft himself, he played with its reality. He wrote a history of it. He encouraged other people to refer to it and to other elements of his tales to create a sense of, like, a larger truth that's hidden behind these fictions. And that you, with your Lovecraftian series, have approached this in many different ways. You wrote a biography of Lovecraft that's sort of, you know, a more, you know, grounded, here's to the story, here's my interpretation, and then you've written your own version of the Necronomicon, and then you've gone even farther and created some, you know, ritual texts that resemble other books of modern occultism that suggest ritual approaches and ways of dealing with talismans and procedures within this kind of universe. So you are also very much active, and you've written Lovecraft fiction. You've written, like so many people, thousands and thousands and thousands of people around the world have written stories in this Lovecraft mode. I mean, he's sort of a genre unto himself. So what I wanted to ask you is what, when you approach your own mixture of creative invention and sort of truth to the mythos or to the lore as it exists, how do you negotiate that? I mean, in some ways, you're you're taking this new tradition farther, and you're inventing tools and ways of thinking about it. But in other ways, you really experience it and think of it as a legitimate path with its own coherence. So how do you do that? How do you approach that blend of fact or of tradition and fiction in your own work?
Well, magic is based upon a few simple principles, and those principles are pretty much eternal, which is to say that the magic that we work today is worked in much the same way, and it has the same rationale as the magic that a shaman might have worked on the steppes of what is now Russia, like 20,000 years ago. It hasn't changed. Magic, whether you can argue about whether magic is effective or not, but an interesting fact about magic is that it really hasn't changed. It's changed in a few outward aspects, you know, names have changed, but the essential principles haven't changed at all. They're fixed. And if you want to take Lovecraft's mythology and apply it in a practical way, you have to use those basic principles. And that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to take Lovecraft's mythology, which he never intended to be a practical system of magic. He wrote the stories really to take control of his dream world. And with his conscious mind, you know, he was an atheist and he denied any reality to these beings at all. But nonetheless, these beings do have a great deal of presence and power on the astral level. But if you want to use them in a practical way, you have to relate them to some structure that allows you to manipulate them and communicate with them. And the way I did it, I took seven of the key figures, the great old ones, and I related them to the seven traditional planets of ancient astrology. And those are the moving bodies in the night heavens that you can see with the naked eye. Ancient astrology had the sun and moon, and it had five planets because you could only see five planets with the naked eye. And it's a very complex and a very complete structure that was really perfected by the Persians maybe 4,000 years ago, you know, those people who predate the Persians of today. Modern astrology, it's been modified and people have added to it, but again, the same principles are used, the same astrological principles. So I used astrology as a kind of a skeletal structure to construct a new form of magic using Lovecraft's great old ones. Now, I've been criticized for this because a lot of fans of Lovecraft will say, well, you've taken these stories that are so wonderful because they're so mysterious and they're so cosmic and they're so separated from human beings that, you know, they're not like anything else. They're not like the ordinary demons of most horror literature. You've taken these things and you've kind of brought them down to earth and you've related them to system of astrology, and it's kind of trivialized them to a certain extent. And I can understand that argument, but at the same time, if you're going to use Lovecraft's mythology in a practical way, you have to give it substance, you have to give it structure, and that's what I've tried to do. I've used my knowledge of the entire scope of Western magic, you know, dating back thousands of years, And I've extracted the basic principles, and I've applied them to Lovecraft's mythology in the best way I could to construct a workable system of magic.
And then at the same time, you've also, you know, written fiction inside the world. You've wrote a book from the perspective of the author of the Necronomicon, and even the Necronomicon itself that you produce has a lot of stories and fiction in them. Do you feel like an extra kind of like pressure when you're writing that stuff to try to, like, you know, tap into the same dream world that Lovecraft was doing, or do you also just go, oh, now I'm just going to extend it in my own, with my own imagination, my own fantasy as well?
No, I actually think I did tap into a certain amount of Lovecraft's own astral world. When I wrote my version of the Necronomicon, I was motivated to do it by just a desire to get everything that Lovecraft had written about this fictional book of his, this dread grimoire that that never existed, but which people would like to exist, to make exist. I mean, people are determined to make the Necronomicon into a real historical book. You know, they won't take no for an answer. When you tell them that it's a complete fiction created by Lovecraft, they resist this idea. They want the Necronomicon to be real. And so Lovecraft was asked to write the Necronomicon. His fans would write to him and say, why don't you actually write the Necronomicon? And Lovecraft said, well, you know, maybe I'll do it someday, but it's a big book, and it's kind of a daunting task. And he didn't know if he was up to it. And as it turned out, he never did attempt to write the Necronomicon. And other people have tried to do it after him, and I'm one of them. But what I wanted to do was take all that Lovecraft had written about the Necronomicon and put it in the context of an expanded universe. I wanted to take what he had written as though it were seeds and make those seeds sprout and grow and develop into something. And so my Necronomicon, as much as possible, it contains everything that Lovecraft ever wrote about the Necronomicon, but it also contains a great deal more. And I've extended what Lovecraft wrote, and of course it's my own creation, but I did have the sense in writing it that I was drawing upon a very deep well of kind of astral reality.
Do you have a similar dream life at all? Do you relate to Lovecraft's dream life?
I do, yeah. I don't know that I dream as strongly as Lovecraft, but I do dream strongly enough that I've written stories based on my dreams. For example, I have a story that's going to be published in an anthology edited by S.T. Joshi called Black Wings 3. The story is called Waller, and people who read that story, they should be aware that it's a completely based on one of my dreams. Essentially, I did exactly what Lovecraft did. I dreamed this story, and when I woke up, I wrote it down as best I could and developed the story from the dream. It's essentially just a retelling of the dream. So that was Lovecraft's procedure, and I've done it myself on a number of occasions. That's just the latest time.
Yeah, it's interesting. What do you think is the spiritual value? I've asked this to other people because it comes up a lot when people start talking about dream world. It's a lot of times people talk about dreams and they emphasize the transcendent dreams, the dreams they're flying or they meet a god, all these, you know, like a wonderful, positive, incredible, delicious. But then there's nightmares. And some people, you know, they really don't want to deal with nightmares. They would prefer to not have nightmares. They think of not having nightmares as some kind of, you know, advance. But I think there's something to the nightmare experience just in itself. It has its own kind of truths to tell, its own sort of spirituality, if you will. And I'm curious how you feel about that. It's like, what is the value of nightmares?
Well, nightmares are the most powerful dreams we have. I mean, the dreams that stay with us, usually the dreams that stay with us are the nightmares. Now, that's not invariably true. Occasionally you'll have a dream that has an exceptional reality and a special significance, and you know at the time that you're having it that this dream is not an ordinary dream. It's a message or a transmission from some other source, you know? And I've had dreams of that nature. Those are dreams which are, they're not the ordinary dreams. They are transcendent dreams. But nightmares, generally speaking, nightmares are the most intense form of dreams. And I've always enjoyed my nightmares. There came a point, when you work in magic rituals frequently, when you do them every day, when you do ritual work every day, it stirs up the subconscious. And people who have worked in rituals will understand what I'm talking about here. You end up getting frequent nightmares and quite horrifying nightmares. those who have worked in the occult, this scares people off from the occult, you know. They think this is some kind of sign that the devil is after them or God is displeased with them or whatever. But really, it's just a psychological reality of doing ritual work. It stirs up a lot of mud in the bottom of the subconscious mind, and you end up having intense, horrifying nightmares. So some years ago, they got to a point where they were troubling me enough that I requested my familiar spirit to stop them, and I haven't had any nightmares since then. I've been nightmare-free for quite a few years.
Fascinating.
But while I was having nightmares, I enjoyed them, and I would write down some of the nightmares and develop them into stories. So I've lost that source of stories to a large extent. I still have dreams that are disturbing, but when I requested that this spirit stop the nightmares, they simply stopped. That was it.
That's amazing. Hey, we only have about 5 minutes left or so, and I wanted to also ask you about this book, which seems sort of along the lines of what we've been talking about, not Lovecraftian, but in terms of a mixture of fiction and sort of magical lore. This Liber Lilith, a Gnostic grimoire, which I noticed I went on to Amazon, and it's selling for a pretty $200 plus a pop in a long out of print edition, but it's coming back into print. And I read the reviews, and they were amazing because the people are like, "Whoa, this is a really heavy book. It may be fiction, but you don't want to deal with it." Some guys were like, "Yeah, it's great, but I really wouldn't recommend people to be looking at this unless you're really ready for it." So clearly, you wrote a very potent text there with Liber Lilith. So it's coming back into print. What is this book about?
Yes, it should be back into print later this year with Starfire. Liber Lilith is a Gnostic grimoire. That's the heart of the book, and that's a received text. I received one chapter of the Gnostic grimoire per day, and I'd receive it after doing a ritual invocation. So what I do, I did this in the afternoon usually. I'd sit down, I'd perform a ritual, and I'd write down just what came into my head. I'd just take it down the way a stenographer would take it down. And I did that progressively day after day, one chapter at a time. Chapters are quite brief. So the Gnostic grimoire, which is the heart of the book, is a received text. But in order to explain that to the reader, I wrote a fictional account of a German magician who finds the Gnostic grimoire and decides to work the magic, to work that system of magic. And this German magician gets into a certain amount of trouble when he invokes the demoness Lilith, who is the queen of hell. And he finds his consciousness is being transformed in ways that are not necessarily what he desired at the beginning of the invocation. So it's really an interesting book in the sense that it's half received grimoire, received text, and you know it's a book of magic. It's a practical text of magic, and it's also half a fictional account of how you would work this system of magic and what might happen to you if you do work it. And it's a warning, you know. It's a warning to those who might choose to work the magic of Liber Lilith. It's just an example of what happens to this German magician, and they might want to consider that before they work this grimoire.
So here's the question. So let's say you do this ritual, you channel this text. It has a certain, it's a received text, and you've scribbled it out, and you realize that it's quite a potent thing, and that it's quite dangerous in some ways, and so you wrap it up in a text and put it out there. What are your motivations for putting that out there? Is it that it's just part of your creative process, you're committed to that creative process? Is it that there's something in, quote-unquote, evil that we have to learn from, that people need to wrap their heads around? Is that the wrong way to think about it? Does that make sense?
It's not so much evil. It's more a matter of dangerous in the sense that it's powerful. It's potent.
Right.
And it can hurt you. It can burn you the way fire or electricity can burn you. I think the main reason I write all my books is just because I'm a writer and it's in my nature to create. You know, I'm a creator. And I can't always choose exactly what I'm going to create. You know, my mind will focus on one thing or another thing and I bring it forth. And I try to bring it forth without judgment as I'm creating it. And that's what I did with Libra Lilith. The actual grimoire came forth completely in the way Athena sprang from the thigh of Zeus, you know, fully formed. I mean, I didn't really design that at all. I didn't have any conscious input into the nature of it. But once I created it, I had to decide what to do with it. I mean, I had to decide, do I just put this away in a drawer somewhere, or do I try and get it published as a straight grimoire and people won't really understand what it is or how to use it, or do I maybe add this fictional account to it so it'll give people some idea of not only how to work the magic, but also the consequences of working the magic. And that's what I did.
Yeah, it's a wonderful exploration of that same boundary between, you know, the edges of fiction and how fiction can lead into a different, you know, a different kind of experience, a different set of experiences. But it also going to be something specific about Lilith, and we just have a couple minutes left here. But there's something particular about her. I know another mage who wrote a sort of Lilith invocation in kind of a larkish way, or sort of out of a kind of very free form sort of chaos magical operation, and it became quite intense. People really started using it and working with it, and it kind of took on a life of its own. And there's something particular about that figure and how she functions in Western consciousness that seems unique to me.
Well, she's an ancient being. She goes back to ancient Sumeria. And the Hebrew Kabbalists, they were the ones who identified her as the bride of Samael and the queen of hell. Lilith, for the Hebrews, was definitely a demon. She was the strangler of children. She was responsible for crib death, and she was also a seductress. She had two forms, an old hag who came to the cribs of children and took the breath away from children and killed them, and for which it was said that all children belonged to Lilith. And by that was meant she has power over the life or the death of all children, all infants. But her other form is a young maiden who comes to men and has sex with them while they sleep and provokes nocturnal emissions. You know, she's the one that gives them wet dreams. And so those are her two aspects. Now, in modern times, the feminists have seized on the figure of Lilith and they've glorified her as the goddess of abortions, you know, which is really fairly appropriate when you think about it, because she was, in ancient times, she was considered to be the slayer of young children.
Oh, that's
so
great.
Yeah, and of course she's also the liberated woman because she has sex outside of marriage, you know. So, so the feminists have turned her into a goddess, and they quite approve of her. So she has those two aspects going, that kind of that dynamic interplay of energy, being a demon and also a goddess at the same time.
Well, Donald, we're going to have to end it there. This was a really fascinating conversation. I'm really glad you joined me here on Expanding Mind.
Okay, thank you very much. It was good talking with you.
Yeah, and you can, folks out there, you can go to DonaldTyson.com, find out more about his books. And so from all of us here and all you out there, keep your minds open.